You're tuned into the most dangerous station in the nation. This is Don Letts of Big Audio Dynamite. You're listening to WUSB, Stony Brook.
Oh yeah, we're dangerous, all right. We're also hot as hell. I don't know. It's cool outside. It's hot inside. Go figure. It's just about 6 o'clock on a Tuesday night. That means it's time for the button not to work on the CD player again. How about that? All right, I'm going to try this. I'm going to be calm. All right. Well, we have the old CD player back, and it's up to its old tricks. It's off the wall. And, yeah, I don't mean to complain about everything, but you wouldn't believe my headphones are doing now. It's very distracting. Well, imagine, a pipe in my voice is coming in and out like this. You know, that is basically the way that it sounds to me. Okay, that's what I have to deal with. But I can do it. I can do it. I just need to sit back for a second and I can do this. Probably the thing we should do first, before we get into everything else, is our weekly Tommy Chong tribute, because this is a particularly good one. In fact, it's one that I totally forgot about. The beauty of this is that I'm kind of reliving my childhood by hearing these pieces that I haven't heard since, my childhood, I guess. I don't know why that is. They were pretty good. But they actually played them on the radio. When's the last time you heard a real Cheech and Chong piece on the radio? Or anything, really. You know, a comedy piece. Anything other than the music that you're programmed to like by Clear Channel and all the others. It doesn't happen very often. There's not much variety. I used to hear Monty Python on commercial radio. And this wasn't that long ago. Things have changed radically. Thank God for tape recorders, because you can prove that it actually happened. But we have information on when Tommy Chong exactly is going to be released. And you can get the same information, too, by going to a really nifty website. Yes, that's right. The Bureau of Prisons runs a website where you can look up prisoners and find out all kinds of things, I guess. I don't think you can find out what they're in there for. Oh, well. Just have to survive with that information. But basically what you do is you go to their website, which is inmate... Actually, let's try this first. I'm going to go to BOP.gov, because that's the Bureau of Prisons, and that's their website. And I believe on there, yes, Inmate Locator. If you go to the left-hand part of the page, click on Inmate Locator. Welcome to the BOP Inmate Locator. You may search the database using the inmate's register number, DCDC number, FBI number, INS number, or by using the inmate's first and last name. Our database includes all federal inmates from 1982 to present. Visits to this website may be monitored. Please see our privacy notice. Blah, blah, blah. Okay. So, let's... I can search by first and last name, huh? Hang on. I gotta see if there's any Emmanuel Goldstein's in prison. Okay. Entering it now. There's Emmanuel and no middle initial. G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N or I-E-N? E-I-N. Thank you. And find inmate. We have no record of an inmate named Emmanuel Goldstein in our database. Okay, that's good. That's good. I think it's good. I don't know what I would have done if I found one. But you can certainly... Let me try a more common name. George Bush. Okay. And let's see what we find. Oh, look at that. There's even a George W. Bush. Okay, we got to find this guy. George W. Bush, he's 46 years old. Well, Bush is older than that, right? He's also not African American. But, oh, if only. If only. And this guy is, he's at the Oakdale FCI in Oakdale, Louisiana. Well, I'll bet that would make an interesting interview, wouldn't it? Okay, but regardless, this is how you find out when Tommy Chong is going to be released, by plugging in his ID number. I guess it's a register number. Let me just make sure I'm giving out the right number here. It's 07... Oh, this is public information, so I'm not giving out his SSN or anything like that. 07798-068 is his number, and when we click on that, we find Thomas B. Kin Chong. I don't know what all that in the middle is. Age, this is interesting. I printed this out last week, and I'm looking at the screen now. His age has changed since last week. He was 65 last week. He's 66 now. How about that? What are the odds of that? But his release date remains the same, July 6, 2004. And he's being held at Taft CI and Taft CA, Taft, California. Now we know when he's going to be released. And even after you get released, this thing keeps track of you. It doesn't say where you are, but it just says that you're out. Out and about. And they're leaving the light on for you for when you come back. So now we know when Tommy Chong will be released from prison. Tommy Chong, in case those of you waking up out of comas that have been in them for over 20 years, he has been put in prison for selling bongs on the internet. That happened last year. And dreadful crime. Unbelievable that such a thing could even be prosecutable. But what we're going to play now is part of our weekly tribute, where we explore his work over the years where he's been active. And of course, you know, we've said this before too, this is what he's really being judged for, is this kind of flouting of authority, glorification of the drug culture, that kind of thing. But I think the guy's a genius. He's able to portray characters very well and very humorously. And this piece coming up is a semi-musical piece. I know we played a musical piece a couple of weeks ago. This one has music in it, too. It features Alice Bowie. Alice Bowie. Now, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that is just basically a mixture of Alice Cooper and David Bowie as a fictitional type of rock star type of persona. Pay special attention to the lyrics of the song, which you will hear in this piece, because I think they're great. And, of course, the rest of the piece is great as well. So we're going to play that, and then we'll get into the rest of the show. Tommy Chong, along with Cheech Marin here on Off the Wall.
Oh, what you just bought. You get your little fanny perpendicular and get ready for school.
I'm not going to school.
What do you mean you're not going to school?
Just what I said. I'm not going to school.
And why not?
Because I'm sick. That's why I'm not
sick. You're sick, all right. What's wrong with you now, Prince Charming?
I got an earache.
Earache my eye. How would you like a buttache? Now get your little fanny out of that bed and clean up this room. It looks like a pigsty. You hear me? All right, that's enough. That's enough. You pushed me far enough, young man. You're getting punished. Now stand up.
No.
I said stand up.
I let go of my hair, man.
Now, young man, I have talked to you and talked to you and talked to you till I'm blue in the face and I'm done talking to you.
Good. Does that mean you're done spitting on me, too?
Shut up. I'm not done talking to you. Now turn around and bend over.
What are you going to do, you pervert?
Pervert? Why are you snotty? Oh, shut up. I haven't even touched it yet. Now I want you to know this is going to hurt you a lot more than it's going to hurt me.
Oh, wow. That didn't even hurt.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, wow. What are you trying to do, tickle me?
Tickle you? Yeah, I'll tickle you. On and get your little butt ready for school right now. You understand?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, youth. Yes. Who among us has not been there? That brings back such memories. What a great song. You know, I heard the riff of the song, and I knew it from someplace. I forgot it was Cheech and Chong. Anyway, Tommy Chong, of course, playing the role of the kid, and quite convincingly, too. That piece called Earache My Eye, and wow. Yeah, okay, so that's our Tommy Chong tribute for this week, and we only have a few more weeks left. He'll be out on July 6th. So hopefully he'll be making new material, too. Even at the age of 66. Hard to believe. Really is hard to believe. Okay, so there's all kinds of things happening, as always, in the world, and we're going to try and take a look at as many of them as possible. And we're also going to try to take some phone calls, maybe a little later in the show. So stay tuned. Let's see what we have here. Well, of course, sympathies to George W. Bush falling off the bike. You know, It's tough. It's a tough life out there, but, you know, it doesn't have to be that tough. You don't have to challenge all these worthy adversaries. You know, it's not worth the fight. I'm talking about things like, you know, bicycles, pretzels, Iraq, Segways, you know, all these things that are a little too much to handle. Maybe other people can handle them, but obviously you can't, and that's okay. That's okay, because there's something else you can do, I'm sure. I'm sure there's another way to help out. And right now, I think the best way is to start cleaning the place up, because there's going to be new tenants soon. Hopefully. Yes, President Bush fell off his bike on Saturday while riding on his ranch, so that explained why, when he was giving that speech last night, he looked all bandaged. Well, he wasn't bandaged. He just kind of bruised on his chin and things like that. He fell about 16 miles into a 17-mile ride. He suffered minor abrasions to his chin, upper lip, nose, right hand, and both knees, but was able to ride back home. Yeah, and of course, that's the first story that we're going to look at. Now, the second story that I'd like to focus on, which is kind of funny and humorous and tells just where America stands in the rest of the world. Did you see the story about the cleaning of David, Michelangelo's David? Oh, come on. You know what it is. Famous statue. It was even on The Simpsons once. It had decades of grayish grime stripped from its body, I guess. It's celebrating its 500th anniversary, this year. And the restoration resumed in September after an aborted start when the original restorer quit in a dispute over how the statue should be cleaned. Yeah, I can imagine. David draws 1.2 million admirers a year, making it one of the art world's biggest draws. And while the restoration reportedly proceeded without surprises, the scrutiny exposed what appeared to be fragility of the statue's ankles, which support more than 6 tons of dead weight. Did you know that? David weighs 6 tons. Boy. David is still itself, only what has changed is his luminosity, said restorer Cinzia Parnagani, who, working atop scaffolding for months, applied mud packs of cellulose pulp and clay to soak away the dirt as tourists gawked. After months of restoration, the sculpture is less cold, she said in an interview with the AP. A veteran of Renaissance art restoration, who used distilled water to clean Michelangelo's unfinished series of sculptures, Prisoners, which is in the Accademia, which is in Florence. Parnagani replaced another respected restorer, Agnes Parenchi, who feared water could harm the surface. Parenchi wanted to brush away the dirt in a dry cleaning. It would be presumptuous to hope to placate polemics over the restoration, Parnagani said Monday. I tried to do my best, but I'm sure someone might not be happy. All right. Obviously, it's a big fight we don't want to get involved in. But the point I'm bringing up here, I saw this story in two places. Actually, I saw it in a number of places. And without any kind of exception that I was able to find, and maybe somebody can update me and tell me if I'm wrong, I saw this on CNN. And there are all kinds of pictures of the restored David statue throughout the CNN site. And you know what? They were very careful not to go below the waist. I mean, you know, David is a naked statue. But still, these American media outfits are afraid of offending some godforsaken person somewhere who is going to get offended by seeing a picture of the penis of a statue. I mean, for God's sake, how crazy has this gotten? I mean, that has to be it, right? I mean, the only reason you would show just headshots of a statue that's famous for its pose would be because you don't want to offend somebody, or perhaps the children might see it by accident. So, yeah, of all the sites I was visiting in the States, I basically found the same thing. But when I went to BBC, there it is, in its pure splendor. Right there, Michelangelo statue cleanup ends, and boy, you see everything. And was I ever offended? Oh, my goodness. This is just one of many things I think we have to fix. I don't know how we ever got this way. How did this happen? Well, one of the ways we can fix things like this is just by constantly examining our values, our morals, our way of life, and poking fun at it wherever possible. And cartoons are one way to do that. I found a great cartoon, thanks to a friend of mine who directed me to this, called Tedrall, the cartoon. It's online. I think it's only online. And you can see it by going to www.ucomics.com/RALLCOM. And there you'll find, this will come out every day, it comes out every couple of days, you'll find an archive. And just to read you a couple of them, which translate well over the radio. Basically, it's a lot of words and some funny faces, but basically it's a four-panel cartoon here. Wait a minute, we invade another country, we bomb the hell out of them, we kill and maim and push them around. People who live there start shooting at us, and we call them terrorists. Ain't language grand. Of course, this is with all kinds of pictures of soldiers and caskets and crazy people and that kind of thing. But the one which I think really provokes a lot of attention and controversy is this one, too. I don't have the date. I believe it's May 13th, but I can't swear to that. Four panels again, four different scenes. The sushi sucks, but I support the chef, says a guy with his head in the toilet. The building is butt ugly, but I support the architect. says a woman looking at a building that's falling apart. I miss my wife, but I support her murderer, says a guy talking to a prisoner. And then the final scene, guy in a peace shirt, waving a flag, saying, I'm against the war, but I support the troops. Yeah, you know, I've heard the phrase said many times in anti-war marches and rallies and meetings and things like that, that, well, we support the troops more than anybody because we want them not to be there. And I think that's a valid statement, but it can be misinterpreted as meaning you support the machinery. I think maybe it needs to be, you know, tweaked a little bit. Not so much the troops, you support the human beings who make up the troops. And you'd like for them to continue to survive for a bit longer by not being in a stupid war with no reason. And on that subject, we didn't touch on this last week, but I'd like to touch on it a little bit this week. And that's the killing of Nick Berg. He's the guy that was beheaded on video. Now, I know that there are many copies of the video out there. I have not looked at it. I can't bring myself to look at a guy being beheaded. Although, I've heard from a number of sources that it may not be exactly what it seems. Even so, you know, I have trouble looking at some scenes in movies, and I know that's not what it seems, but still, if something is gruesome enough, and the guy is certainly dead. It's just something that I think you lose something when you expose yourself to that too much. And that could be part of why our society is all messed up these days. But the video's out there. Certainly, if you want to see it, you just have to type into a search engine, and I'm sure you'll find it without any problem. But there are a number of questions that are being raised about the whole circumstance. And I'd just like to read some of this to you. And see what you think about this. A large number of anomalies surround the life and death of Nicholas Berg, a Jewish man, 26 years of age, and a U.S. citizen. He traveled alone in Iraq. And, you know, that wasn't mentioned, actually, the first media reports of his death, that he was Jewish. And that certainly does play into things in a place like Iraq. Family and friends describe Berg as an adventurer, high-spirited, and intelligent. A Washington Post report notes Berg was a weightlifting enthusiast and amateur comedian who had traveled abroad to help people improve their lives. Among his trips was a visit to the West African country of Ghana, where he taught villagers to make bricks and returned emaciated because he gave away most of his food. Berg visited Iraq from December 2003 to January 2004, and then again starting March 14, 2004. Berg was purportedly looking for electrical contracting work, building radio towers. He could not find work, though there was reportedly plenty. It does seem kind of strange that you wouldn't be able to find work with contractors all over the place there. On March 24th, Iraqi officials arrested Berg at a checkpoint in Mosul and jailed him because of his Jewish last name and the Israeli stamp in his passport. This according to a Washington Post report. Berg told friends in Baghdad that the Israelis thought he might be a spy. Actually, this has got to be a typo. I'm sure he meant this website means Iraqis thought he might be a spy. I think the Israelis would know if he was a spy. On April 5th, 2004, the Bergs filed suit in federal court in Philadelphia, contending that their son was being held illegally by the U.S. military in Iraq. Yeah. You may have seen this in the media. I saw it reported a couple of times. They actually brought the U.S. government to court. The next day, April 6th, Nick Berg was released. And on Saturday, May 8th, a month later, Berg's body was found outside of Baghdad on a highway overpass. On May 11th, 2004, a video of Nick Berg's execution, seemingly by beheading, was posted on the Muntada al-Ansar website, which is now offline. Now, the video of the killing has many flaws, including problems with time skips, audio dubbing, and the characteristics, appearance, and speech of Berg and the killers. People from Middle Eastern cultures believe that Middle Eastern people were not involved in this video, based on the mannerisms, accents, behavior, and appearance of the killers. A close inspection of the video suggests that Westerners may have been involved. And you see, this is one of the reasons why I think it's very important to to always look at every piece of evidence with as many people, as many experts out there as possible. I'm not sure how much of what I'm reading here actually is deserving of merit, but it certainly is deserving of investigation. And if you're someone who knows something about any of these subjects, you might want to take a look at that particular part of the video being described and see if it's true or not. There's nothing to be gained by keeping these things secret. And if you have the stomach to actually view this thing, then at least something good might come out of that. Some of the points we're about to mention are compelling. Some are weak or may turn out to be insignificant or coincidental. This webpage, which I'll give out the address to when I'm finished reading, it's a work in progress, an early overview of discrepancies. There are too many discrepancies and contradictions to dismiss doubts about the video and the official U.S. stories about Berg. Additional inquiry and fact-checking are needed as the Berg story unravels. Here are some suspicious circumstances that I've picked out of a long list. A Jewish man and U.S. citizen traveling alone in Iraq. Why did a private Jewish American citizen choose to wander around Iraq by himself? He also had a passport stamp from Israel, very unsafe to travel with. Berg wanted to return home. In his last email on April 6th to his family, Berg stated he wished to return home as soon as possible. The FBI claimed that he refused an offer of help to get home. Actually, I read that wrong. The FBI claims he refused an offer of help to get home. There were three FBI visits. The FBI made three visits to Berg while he was in custody in Iraq. This suggests that U.S. authorities were concerned about more than Berg's well-being. They may have had their own suspicions about what the young American was doing in Iraq. Berg's last known whereabouts was in U.S. custody. On April 1st, Beth Payne, the U.S. consular officer in Iraq, sent an email to the family of Nick Berg. It stated that Ms. Payne had located Nick and he was currently in custody of the U.S. military. She wrote, quote, "I have confirmed that your son Nick is being detained by the U.S. military in Mosul. He is safe. He was picked up approximately 1 week ago. We will try to obtain additional information regarding his detention and a contact person you can communicate with directly." The U.S. military has stated that Berg was never in U.S. custody and that he had been in custody of the Iraqi police. The Iraqi police adamantly deny he was ever in their custody. If this is so, we have to conclude that either the email from Ms. Payne was incorrect or that the U.S. military has been lying. Imagine that. Berg was mysteriously captured while still wearing a jumpsuit. One of those orange jumpsuits that you see in prison. Either he escaped from U.S. captors or the U.S. let him out with orange suit and all to be immediately apprehended by terrorists, in quotes, before he had a chance to change. Does seem very weird. We've all seen that part of the video, the freeze frame where he's wearing an orange jumpsuit. I don't think they use those in terrorist cells, do they? It would seem awfully bizarre if they did. But we know they use them in American prisons, and presumably American prisons overseas. Another possibility is that the captors somehow came across a U.S. military prison jumpsuit. The family blames detainment by the U.S. military for Berg's death. The last time the family heard from Nick Berg was on April 9th. He had planned to return home at the end of March. His headless body was found near Mosul on May 8th. Michael Berg says of his son, "That's really what cost my son his life, the fact that the United States government saw fit to keep him in custody for 13 days without any of his due process or his civil rights." Pretty strong words. And then, of course, we have the extremely convenient wag-the-dog timing at the height of furor regarding the U.S. Torture of Iraqis. Here's more on the orange jumpsuit. Berg is shown in the video wearing an orange jumpsuit known to be of U.S. issue. The orange jumpsuit appears to be identical to the jumpsuits used at Guantanamo. The orange jumpsuit was standard U.S. military issue to men in custody. It is unlikely Berg would continue wearing a U.S. custodial uniform if he had been released by the military, as they claim. The fact he was still wearing the suit is both anomalous and suggestive. One wonders, was there an immediate transfer of Berg from the U.S. military to unknown persons, preventing Berg from discarding his U.S. prison garb? And keep in mind also that there was no contact with Berg after that period of time. No phone calls, no emails, nothing like that. Now, getting into the actual gruesome tape that was released. When Berg is decapitated, there is almost no blood. Now, if Berg was still alive at this point, with the cut starting at the front of the throat, blood would have been spraying everywhere. I'm going to take their word on this. Berg's severed head, the floor, Berg's clothes, and even the hand of the quote-unquote Arab who decapitated Berg had no visible blood on it. When the executioner holds up Berg's head immediately following what is represented as an actual decapitation of a living person, there is no significant blood flow from the neck or blood splatters showing anywhere on the executioner. Berg seems limp just before the beheading, and it's not clear if he was moving about after the time skip in the tape. While on the ground, Berg's body didn't seem to move except in response to the captor's movements. Although held down, Berg would have tried to instinctively wiggle and writhe away from the captor's grip and use of a knife. Now, that is, unless he was long dead after the cut in the tape. A surgeon would very likely testify that the beheading did not cause the death. The lack of spurting blood and lack of movement suggests Berg was already dead at the time of the alleged decapitation. During the beheading, Berg's eyes are not seen. Camera angle makes it impossible to see if Berg's eyes were open or glassy. Berg very probably was killed before the staged beheading. Did the captors have no stomach for the beheading of a living person? The cut on Berg's neck seems to be too straight to have been done crudely and with such speed by a man wielding a large knife. Anybody who has carved a turkey knows there is something wrong with the supposed beheading. The suspended head looks more like Berg had been neatly beheaded by a guillotine. Now, moving on to some less gruesome material. The chair that Berg was seated in during the filming was the exact same kind as seen in a color photo taken at the Abu Ghraib prison. All right, you know, that's... who knows? Who knows how many of those chairs there are, how common they are. But this is also interesting. The walls and baseboard at the killing site are the same color as some scenes from that very same prison. Again, that could be very common. After all, it was an Iraqi prison. Maybe they like those colors. A Reuters journalist, and this is the part I take umbrage at as far as the way the story was released. A Reuters journalist in Dubai first named the Muntada al-Ansar al-Islami website as the source for the video, and that was at www.al-ansar.biz. Yeah, finally we're getting some websites out of this. That's www.al-ansar.biz. We're always hearing about these Al-Qaeda websites, but they never give out the URLs, and you have to wonder how they know where to go. Although the site has now been shut down, AlJazeera.net had looked at the site within 90 minutes of the story breaking and could find no such video footage. Yet, Fox News, CNN, and the BBC were all able to download the footage from the Arabic-only website and report the story within the hour. Getting back to some of the more heinous stuff here. There's speculation that the scream in the video was dubbed in. The screaming starts while Berg is not moving and before he is touched. Whatever the mismatch in the speaker and video, videotape experts have said the scream was amateurishly dubbed into the tape. Now, here's some specific info with timing and all that. The screaming starts at 4:31. And that was on a copy, not necessarily the timestamp. About 5 to 6 seconds before Berg is touched at 4:36, and he is moved to his side. He is just sitting there like a lump. While the screaming commences for 5 seconds, his head doesn't move and his mouth doesn't appear to move. although the tape is blurry. Nor does he seem to be physically screaming at any time, yet the audio plays a loud, vigorous screaming. The exact same dubbed screaming continues after the long time jump, and a bit of a time gap with silence, and after some cutting on the head, during which Berg is not moving. This screaming seems clearly dubbed and is highly incongruous with Berg's lack of activity. Now, something else involving the handling of papers on the videotape. The terrorist reader flips through pages of a so-called statement at one point. He keeps ending up on the same page for a while. Now, this would likely produce a gap in speech, which is out of sync with the smooth timing of the spoken statement. And when the story broke on the first day, it was reported on several major news networks that Al-Qaeda was connected to the killer's statement. This turned out to be false. The U.S. intelligence translation still retains this reference to Al-Qaeda, which does not exist. The U.S. government translation of one statement made on the film is, "Does Al-Qaeda need any further excuses?" This is a falsification. The actual statement urged fellow insurgents to get off their hind ends and do something. One assumes the translator used by the U.S. military is a native speaker of Arabic, so this may not be an innocent flub. Did the U.S. government intentionally link an alleged Al-Qaeda group into the murder of Nick Berg? Note, the word on the tape was Al-Qaed, A-L-Q-A-E-D, with quite a different meaning from Al-Qaeda. Western body posture and mannerisms of terrorists. That's right. The terrorists have Western-style body posture and mannerisms. They seem to be at parade rest at all times. I have no idea what that means, but it's worth looking into. The terrorists were fat. Several of the men in the film were fat by Iraqi standards. If they were Fedayeen or Mujahideen, they'd probably have been living underground since the first days of the occupation. Tens of thousands of Iraqis have been shown on news stories as they have marched and demonstrated. One would be hard-pressed to point out a single fat man among those thousands of people. I've never actually looked, but that's, again, worth looking into. And for those of you who are weapons experts, firearms experts have stated that the AK-47 carried by one man was a Galil, and this actually is an Israeli-made weapon that improves on the famous AK-47. And insurgents are known to use AK-47s. Now, this is the most bizarre thing. you have to wonder about this one. The FBI has reported that Nick Berg's email account was used by the 20th hijacker of 9/11, Zacharias Moussari, whose computer held evidence of the 9/11 hijackers, and also he couldn't be searched by the FBI field office because of orders from Washington. The FBI interviewed Nick Berg about Moussari's use of his email account to send emails, but concluded that it was entirely coincidental. Berg had apparently given the password to his email account to an acquaintance of Moussari, who he met on a bus in 1999 in Oklahoma. It just gets really bizarre. And again, you know, I don't know how much of this is real and how much of it is nonsense, but it's certainly worth looking into. The story does seem a bit strange. And finally, the final point from this site here, and I think this is maybe the most significant one. Berg's family was not allowed to view the body of Berg on its arrival to the U.S. You can find a lot more on the website www.kuro5hin.org. And just look for Nick Berg's killing, and you'll find many, many pages on that. Interesting. Fascinating story, and one that seems to have disappeared from the media awfully fast. One thing that, though, did appear in the media just a couple of days ago in our own Long Island Newsday, check out this headline, "Failure in Iraq now may be an option." How do you like that? Failure might be an option. Since the invasion of Iraq 14 months ago, a favorite mantra in political Washington has been that failure is not an option. But after the repeated disasters of recent weeks, warnings of the possibility, if not the inevitability, of failure or defeat are beginning to echo through the marble halls of Congress and the ornate conference rooms of Washington think tanks. We need a fast turnaround, and we need it right away, said retired General Joseph Hoar. What an unfortunate name. A former commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East, he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee last week we're about on the brink of failure. Of course, you know, it could have been said just to get more money. It's a known tactic. Anthony Kordsman, a leading Iraq expert and early supporter of the war, wrote in a recent report that while the United States is not yet defeated in Iraq militarily or politically, there is now the threat of a serious strategic defeat. So, yeah, things are changing. Things are changing fast, and you have to ask yourself, what is that going to mean? It's really kind of unexpected to me to even see these words. I think the United States deserves to be defeated over there, because the war obviously is a very bad idea, a big injustice to the rest of the world, not only Iraq. And, of course, a big injustice to the military of this country. But not all the military of this country is deserving of that kind of consideration, obviously. You've seen the pictures. You've probably seen the videos. And that's a video that I think a lot of people should see, the videos that have been released of U.S. torture of Iraqi prisoners. Because that's what you're paying for. Those people over there are your representatives. And the day will come when there is payback for this. And not just one person being beheaded, if that's even what happened. Think of what you would do if people stormed into your town and took you into a prison and treated you in a completely inhumane and barbaric way. Don't think you just brush it off after they let you go without any kind of charge. Not very likely. I think the United States has more enemies now probably than it ever has in its history. It's unbelievable. And it's going to take a lot of work to undo the damage that has been done here. Moving ahead militarily, you know, I don't even see that as an option anymore. We have to look beyond that and figure out how to fix the damage that has been caused. Listen to this. This comes from The Washington Post. Problems in the U.S.-run detention system in Iraq extended beyond physical mistreatment in prison cell blocks, involving thousands of arrests without evidence of wrongdoing, and abuse of suspects starting from the moment of detention. That's according to former prisoners, Iraqi lawyers, human rights advocates, and the International Committee for the Red Cross. You can't dismiss all of them. U.S.-led forces routinely rounded up Iraqis and then denied or restricted their rights under the Geneva Conventions during months of confinement, including rights to legal representation and family visits. In a report in February, that's right, February, the Red Cross stated that some military intelligence officers estimated that 70% to 90% of the persons deprived of their liberty in Iraq had been arrested by mistake. Of the 43,000 Iraqis who have been imprisoned at some point during the occupation, only about 600 have been referred to Iraqi authorities for prosecution. The Red Cross study, posted recently on the Wall Street Journal's website, concludes that the arrest and detention practices employed by U.S.-led forces in Iraq are prohibited under international humanitarian law. The problem with these laws and treaties is that they have no teeth. Who's coming after the United States for violating these things? The UN? The Red Cross? Amnesty International? I mean, no one's doing anything serious about this. Issuing reports is great, but where are the sanctions? You know, where are the penalties? Now, facing international outcry over photographs of prisoner abuse less than 2 months before the planned handover of sovereignty to an interim Iraqi government on June 30th, U.S. officials plan to dramatically reduce the number of Iraqis in military custody from more than 8,000 to fewer than 2,000. The release will send legions of prisoners, many of them angry and hardened by their incarceration, home to Sunni Muslim-dominated parts of north-central Iraq where resistance to the U.S. occupation has been fiercest. What do you think's going to happen? American detention tactics have turned Iraqis such as this guy, Satai Kusai, he's a kebab chef, they turned him against an occupation he once supported. Kusai said he was arrested in June while visiting the house of his brother, a former low-ranking Ba'ath Party official, and he did not see an attorney during his subsequent three-month detention in a fog-bound prison camp in the southern city of Umm Qasr. That's right, there's a lot more than one prison that we're running over there. He said he was forced to endure a shower of soldiers' tobacco juice, eat food off a dirty floor, and urinate on himself when he was prohibited from using bathrooms. "They freed us from an oppressor," said Kusai, 40 years old. "But now I think they came to laugh at us." Prisoners and relatives of detainees interviewed produced prison release papers, Red Cross visitation documents, or identification bracelets as evidence of incarceration over the past year. The descriptions of abuse during arrest or imprisonment could not be independently verified, which I guess means that people weren't rolling the video cameras. The focus on abuse inside the Abu Ghraib prison and other U.S.-run detention facilities has obscured broader problems that began well before Iraqis arrived at the facilities, according to lawyers and rights advocates. The 24-page Red Cross report describes a pattern of excessive force used by U.S. soldiers during raids at homes or businesses, frequently occurring after midnight. And this is something, again, that I've mentioned in the past. This was shown on foreign TV outlets such as the BBC, who are also involved in the war. But you see the video there of U.S. soldiers kicking in doors and scaring the crap out of families in the middle of the night. And if you see that here, I don't think you see it very often. The Red Cross wrote that ill treatment during capture was frequent and that it often included pushing people around, insulting, taking aim with rifles, punching and kicking, and striking with rifles. Such tactics, which seem to reflect a usual modus operandi, appear to go beyond the reasonable, legitimate, and proportional use of force required to apprehend suspects or restrain persons resisting arrest or capture. That according to the Red Cross. Most of the time, according to an assertion contained in the report and corroborated by former prisoners, U.S. soldiers arrested all the men found in a suspect's house. Most of those detained, judging by a sample of prisoners and their descriptions of fellow inmates, have been young to middle-aged men from Baghdad and the Sunni Triangle, which is the area north and west of the capital that is the heart of the anti-occupation resistance. Ahmed Maf Khattab, a 32-year-old plumber, said he was getting a shave in his local barbershop on November 11th when a group of soldiers in U.S. military uniforms entered carrying AK-47s. Red and white scarves covered their faces, he said. "They pulled me from the shop and put me in a Nissan pickup." He said the men spoke English and accused him of being a member of former President Saddam Hussein's paramilitary forces. "They threw me face down, then blindfolded me and handcuffed me." He said he did not know where he was being taken because the soldiers did not remove his blindfold. They started beating him with pipes, starting on his legs and back, then moving to his head. "I was bleeding from my mouth and my ears. I fainted. When I woke up, I was in a dog's cage set in the courtyard of a local military base." He said he was left naked in the cage for several days, receiving only scant food and water, until the soldiers hung him from a tree by his cuffed hands. "They told me they would bring my wife and hang her next to me," he said. According to his release papers, Khattab was taken to Abu Ghraib, where he was held for 4 months before being released without an explanation. His two brothers are still in the prison. How anybody can turn a blind eye to that kind of thing is beyond me. But it continues to this day. And if you really believe that these are isolated instances of torture and abuse, I can't imagine what kind of media reports you've been looking at, what kind of reading of the news, even filtered as it is. You see Donald Rumsfeld saying that Geneva Conventions don't apply here. Well, maybe that message is being passed along down the line two soldiers who interpret that as a free-for-all. They can do whatever they want. Now, if that's not enough for you, take a look at this. This just came out. The coalition in Iraq wants its troops to remain immune from prosecution after the handover of power. Now, what does that tell you? Yeah, well, hand over power to Iraq, and it'll be their country, but we can do what we want, and we can't be charged, except by our own people, who will give us a slap on the wrist. You see, this last week, the guy got a year confinement for torturing people. And then a couple of days later, this other soldier who has been refusing to serve in Iraq for conscientious reasons, because he doesn't believe it's a just war, because he's using his brain, and this is before the prisoner abuse thing even became public, he's sentenced to 1 year, too. The same exact penalty. At one time, he faced the death penalty for desertion. That's the kind of crap we're dealing with now. Torturing. Being treated as a minor infraction. And people who think a little bit too much, threatened with the death penalty. Unbelievable. And then you have the attorney in Oregon. Hear about this? This guy was picked up by the FBI. Happened right here in this country. After the Madrid bombings, they claimed that they found his fingerprint. And he was one of the lawyers involved in that group of people in Portland that was recently convicted of aiding and abetting terrorists because they had planned to go to Afghanistan through China or something like that. So, really bizarre evidence. They wound up pleading guilty, which is what a lot of people do when they're faced with the wrath of the federal government. But that case left a very bad taste in my mouth. But this really was unbelievable because this was their attorney. And he was being accused now of working with terrorists in Spain. Well, yesterday, a federal court threw out the case against Brandon Mayfield. He's a 37-year-old convert to Islam. Ha-ha. There you go. And when he got out, he sharply criticized the government after the announcement, calling his time behind bars humiliating and embarrassing and saying he was targeted because of his faith. I am a Muslim, an American, and an ex-officer of the U.S. military. I believe I was singled out and discriminated against, I feel, as a Muslim. The court cited a fingerprint identification error by the FBI in dismissing the case. FBI officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, had said that Mayfield's fingerprint matched one found on a bag of detonators near the train station in Madrid in the March 11th bombing, which killed 191 people and injured 2,000 others. But last week, Spanish authorities said the fingerprints of an Algerian man were on the bag. Robert Jordan, the FBI agent in charge of the state of Oregon, said the agency regretted any hardship caused by the arrest and said the Bureau would review its practices on fingerprint analyses. Mayfield was released from custody last week after the announcement by Spanish authorities, but he was not altogether cleared of suspicion at that time. The government said he remained a material witness and put restrictions on his movements, and those restrictions were lifted yesterday. He was also subjected to sneak and peek searches, which is allowed under the USA Patriot Act. Sneak and peek search basically allows agents to search a house without telling anybody that they're doing that. And, of course, his treatment was not very nice while he was held. I don't see any details here, but I know it wasn't tantamount to torture, but it certainly wasn't... It wasn't the way prisoners should be treated either. So yeah, that's what we're looking at here. All kinds of abuses and the degradation of the American judicial system, where these kinds of warrants can be served, homes can be searched without the knowledge of the owners, people can be put in prison without charges. Yes, it's to their credit that they admitted their mistake. Of course, they didn't really have much choice when the Spanish authorities said that they had made a mistake. One has to wonder if they would have done that otherwise. Let's hope that something big is made out of this. Let's hope this guy, who's already a lawyer, sues the pants off the U.S. government for this. And let's hope also that justice is found for the many people that have been unfairly victimized. And we're not even getting into the wedding party that was defeated in the northwest part of the country, Iraq, that is, not our country, last week. So it's kind of hard to deny that when you have a videotape of the wedding party, but the U.S. government is trying to do that anyway. Well, I guess if anyone out there is listening and wants to make a really quick call, they can do so, 631-632-9872, but we don't really have much time, especially those people on the Internet who won't hear this for another 3 minutes. Sorry, I guess that's just the way it goes, but we'll take calls next week. But if anyone is out there locally, or if the signal gets out on the Internet faster than normal, we'd like to hear from you. But we sure do live in interesting times, no denying that, and they will get more interesting as the year moves on. As we have the Republican Convention in New York City, the Democratic Convention in Boston, the Olympics in Greece, and who knows what else down the road. All right, let's take a phone call. And good evening, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good, how are you?
Okay, thanks. Hey, listen, is there any chance that you can make, I mean, I appreciate and I like the show a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I like the one you broadcast out of BAI on, I guess that would be, what, tomorrow?
Well, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because we're not on tomorrow. We're preempted because of the fundraiser.
Okay.
And even more bad news, we may be preempted the week after that as well. But that show normally is on Wednesday at 7 on BAI.
It is, okay.
But you like that show better, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm into, you know, I pay attention to politics and all like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the technology talk a lot more than I did.
Well, that's a technology show, and this is kind of a rambling show.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is a difference. There should be. But thanks for listening either way.
I was just sort of hoping you'd have a
go. Okay, well, you can always listen to the archives, too, which are online at www.2600.com. Thanks for that call. Unfortunately, that's going to be... Should we do this one? All right, let's really quickly do this one. Yes, good evening. You're on the air.
Yes, hello, Mayor.
You're calling from Echoland, huh?
I just was thinking about this for a little bit, kind of a quick point that at $5 billion a month and $100 billion supposedly so far, this is just the advertised numbers,
mm-hmm.
What would that work out to per every man, woman, and child in America on the current census? That's like 252 million Americans. I think that comes out to somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 per every man, woman, and child right now.
Wow.
So
that's something to think about. And think about where that money could have gone and how much good it could have done. That could have built a healthcare system.
So that little $300 bonus check that everybody thinks that they got,
mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? You just gave them an extra $100.
Yeah, at least. At the very least.
And then some more is coming.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that bit of cheery news. We're going to close out on that.
Just to put a little financial perspective on it for your listeners.
Very, very valuable to do that. Thank you very much. That money certainly could have been used many different ways. Any different way would have been better. Okay, we're out of time. The Blues is up next. And for the third week in a row, we're going to have a Phil Oakes song, only because this one really seems apropos, too, especially with people talking about reinstating the draft. Yes, we didn't get into that, but there's talk of that as well, maybe next week. And that's when we'll see you next.
Oh, I'm just a typical American boy from a typical American town. I believe in God and Senator Dodd and I keep an old Castro down. And when it came my time to serve, I knew better dead than red. But when I got to my old draft board, buddy, this is what I said. Sarge, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat and my feet are flat and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school and I'm a-working in a defense plant. I got a dislocated disc and a racked up back. I'm allergic to flowers and bugs. And when the bombshell hits, I get epileptic fits and I'm addicted to 1,000 drugs. I got the weakness woes, I can't touch my toes, I can hardly reach my knees. And if the enemy came close to me, oh, I'd probably start to sneeze. I'm only 18, got a ruptured spleen and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, my feet are flat, my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm a-going to school, and I'm a-working in a defense plant. Ooh, I hate showing lies, I hope he dies, but one thing you gotta see, that someone's gotta go over there, and that someone isn't me. So I wish you well, Sarge, give him hell, kill me 1,000 or so, and if you ever get a war without blood and gore, I'll be the first to go. Yes, I'm only 18, I got a ruptured spleen, and I always carry a purse. I've got eyes like a bat, and my feet are flat, and my asthma's getting worse. Yes, think of my career, my sweetheart dear, my poor old invalid aunt. Besides, I ain't no fool, I'm going to school, and I'm working in a defense plan.
Hi, this is Butch Trucks from the Allman Brothers Band, and you're listening to 90.1 WUSB in Stony Brook.